Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. When you call for an ambulance, maybe the last thing you're worrying about is the bill. Perhaps you should be concerned. 21 states already protect consumers from surprise medical bills in some situations, but most ignore the issue of ground ambulances. Kaiser Health News recently published a series on the costs of ambulances, reviewing 350 consumer complaints in 32 states, including Ohio. Joining us by phone is Kaiser Health News correspondent Melissa Bailey. Welcome to the show, Melissa.
Thank you.
Is there an average cost for an ambulance ride? Is there something typical?
So ambulance costs vary immensely. They could be free if it's a volunteer fire service in your town, or it could be thousands of dollars. Medicare typically pays about $300 to $400 of a base rate if in an urban area. But these costs and these prices just vary immensely across the country.
How much do we use ambulances?
The rates of ambulances have been going up, but I don't have the exact figures at my fingertips.
But we use them more than we used to.
Yes.
What goes into the cost determination? How do they figure it out? Is there an equation?
So for Medicare, there's a base rate depending on if it's basic life support or advanced life support, and there's geographic adjustments if it's in an urban area or a rural area, and there's usually a fee per mile. But if you happen to have an ambulance that's out of network, those costs, including the per mile fee, they are not regulated, and there's really no way to predict what the cost will be if you call 911 and jump in an ambulance.
How can you tell if an ambulance is going to be out of network?
So if you're calling 911, you really don't have much of a way to choose who comes, because the dispatcher is just going to dispatch the ambulance that's assigned to that region, or perhaps an ambulance from a nearby town if they need mutual aid to cover the area. If you are in a hospital, you may have a little more choice. So a lot of the complaints that I looked at were patients who were inside a hospital and needed to be transferred to a different facility. And so those patients, if you're in that setting and it's not incredibly urgent, you can ask which ambulance services are on contract with the hospital that you're at and see if any of them take your health insurance.
Would you be able to, though, engage an ambulance service that's in your system? If not?
Yeah, so if you're in a hospital setting, you could have some say in which ambulance might come and take you. Or if you're in a nursing home setting or somewhere where it's not an emergency, you certainly have much more choice. A lot of these cases that I looked at were cases where it was fairly urgent. So, for example, a family with a child, a newborn child in Ohio who was at one hospital, and they didn't have room in the neonatal intensive care unit, so they transferred the child to a different hospital. But that, in that case, the company was out of network. They ended up getting a $900 bill.
Now, $900 doesn't sound like much compared to what I've seen when from reading your article. Some people, one guy out in California is battling a $7,000 or $8,000 or $9,000 bill.
Yeah, so Devin Hall is a retired postal inspector. He's actually facing stage 3 cancer right now, and he's also battling a bill of over $7,000 from the nation's largest ambulance provider. And what happened is he actually went to a hospital that was in network, but they couldn't handle his case, so they transferred him to a different hospital that could handle his case, and he ended up going into a collections agency that the ambulance company hired for this bill, which is over $7,000.
What in the world costs $7,000?
So the service in this, the ambulance provider in this case said that he needed nursing services, and it was a sensitive medical case that he needed medical attention en route to this other hospital, which was 20 miles away. And you're also going to see a mileage charge for that 20 miles.
How does Ohio stack up in this issue?
So there are 21 states that have passed legislation protecting consumers from balance billing. Ohio is not one of those, but I talked to the Department of Insurance, and they said that in Ohio, some people with some types of HMOs are protected from some out-of-network charges. But the problem with a lot of these state bills is they don't apply to most people who have private health insurance, because most people are on plans that are called self-funded employer-sponsored plans. Mm-hmm. And those plans are regulated by the federal government. And so the federal government has no protections against these surprise medical bills or balance bills, particularly in ambulance settings.
Why do you call them balance bills?
Oh, a balance bill means that the health insurance provider, or sorry, the health provider, so in this case, the ambulance, sends a bill, and your health insurance company pays some portion that they deem appropriate, but there's a balance left over. Mm-hmm. And the ambulance company, in this case, turns around to the consumer and says, hey, you now have to pay this balance, and they'll bill the consumer directly.
And then they're just stuck with it.
Yeah, so I looked at a lot of cases where consumers were in being pursued by collections agencies for ambulance bills, and there really isn't much you can do. You can ask an ambulance company for if they have any sort of financial assistance program based mm-hmm. on your income or your medical situation, and you can appeal to your health insurer and say, hey, can you pay more of this bill? But there aren't many legal protections for consumers in this situation.
And ambulance companies respond that they're forced to charge sometimes these exorbitant charges, because insurers don't reimburse at a fair rate.
So their main argument is that Medicare is not paying enough to actually cover the cost of not only sending patients who do take ambulance rides to the where they need to go, but also that ambulance companies need to be on call 24/7 to be ready to take patients, regardless of whether they call or not. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the times when they show up to a scene, when they require to respond to a 911 call, the patient either declines transit or it's not needed. So they end up having to pay for that trip, and they don't get reimbursed for those trips either. And so when you look at the rates that private health insurers are paying, they often say to ambulance companies, you know, we'll only allow you to come into our network if you agree to be paid these Medicare rates, which ambulance companies say are too low.
It sounds like an industry ripe for regulation, but what are the chances of that?
Well, in the specific issue that I looked at, which is consumers facing these balance bills or mm-hmm. these surprise bills when they take ambulance rides, that really would require federal legislation. And there has been some effort in Congress for broader bills protecting consumers from surprise medical bills. But those legislative efforts have not included ambulances. And as we see, it's hard to get much done in Congress right now.
Maria in Virginia, you're the executive vice president of the American Ambulance Association. Maria, what's your last name?
Bianchi.
Bianchi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so very much for having me on.
You bet. You wanted to talk about why ambulances cost so much.
Yes, I did. I think that what I would like to say is we provide pre-hospital health care. So if you're in an ambulance, there is health care being provided. It's not a unique situation when health care is being provided. This many times it's a case of trauma. And, you know, the cost of readiness when you're trying to provide 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days out of the year health care, and respond within 8 minutes and 59 seconds, I think that there are built-in costs that unfortunately, until our healthcare system is revamped, we have to find a way to fund our systems. Because when patients call, and they call all the time, anytime, there is an expectation that we're going to respond, regardless of whether or not it's a inter-hospital facility transport or whether it's a 911 call because of a traffic accident.
You know, 40 years ago, most people, they were free. Things were free. Is there just more medical care going on in ambulances? They're able to do more now, and it just costs more.
It costs more. The number of the call volume has increased exponentially.
And why is that?
In a large part because 40 years ago, they're really, you know, this is a very new industry. The industry started when field medics came back from the Korean War and had this skill set, and the government realized that there was a way of saving lives even before someone got into the hospital.
Huh.
So this is still a relatively new healthcare field, and we're finding out more and more and more that there is a very short window of when you can save a life. And so you're right, the medical interventions that are taking place in the field are much more complex. The level of regulation is, we are a very regulated industry, highly regulated, both at the federal level, the state level, and even with local medical protocols.
I guess, you know, when I was talking about regulations before, I was thinking more about regulations to protect the industry, to give them some kind, you know, to give it, you know, more something, more ability to plan. But everything's up in the air right now.
Everything is, and I guess what I would say is if there was one thing that I would want everybody to take away, because, you know, I think ultimately we all care about the patients that we serve, whether it's yourself or the reporter or anybody. We really just want to serve our patients in the communities that we operate in. But what I would say is what you're seeing with ambulance services is a microcosm of what's happening in the healthcare industry. Mm. We really are the only healthcare provider that provides universal healthcare regardless of ability to pay. If you call 911, we're not going to ask to see your insurance card. Mm. We're not going to. We respond first. And I think we're all very aware that our healthcare system in the United States is fractured and it's breaking. And I think we're the first industry that's really, you know, feeling the effects because of the amount of uncompensated care we give and because of the amount of increased services that we provide.
Are you expecting any kind of uptick because of the aging population?
Absolutely. The largest part of our transportation and our medical care goes to Medicare recipients. Medicare and Medicaid make up about anywhere, depending upon the system, between 50% of all transports to, you know, 65-70% of all transports. And as we age, we utilize services more.
Well, Maria Bianchi, thank you so much for joining us. I'm glad you could join the conversation.
Thank you very much for having me, and I appreciate any future discussion we can have about this. It's a critical issue in this industry and in this country, so thank you for your time.
You bet. Maria Bianchi, she's Executive Vice President of the American Ambulance Association. Also, Melissa Bailey of Kaiser Health News, the correspondent, will have links to the articles on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Melissa, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Electronic cigarettes have received mixed reviews. Still, the global e-cigarette market is growing to an estimated $34 billion by 2021. Big tobacco is often considered competition, but tobacco companies have actually come to dominate the vaping market, and it shows. Some e-cigarette makers have taken marketing cues from big tobacco. Journalist Liza Gross recently wrote about the e-cigarette industry for The Verge. She joins us by phone. Welcome, Liza Gross.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You start your piece with a professor from Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. He's attending the first e-cigarette summit in Washington, D.C. this past May. Tell us about Dr. Samir Sona. Is it Sanaji?
Sanaji.
Sanaji, yeah.
Yes. Yes. He had a very interesting experience. So he's a scientist who uses models to understand how policy affects long-term health trends. And most recently, he's been looking at how gaps in regulations on novel tobacco products, which include e-cigarettes, might affect health over the long term. He's used to going to scientific conferences and presenting his findings, and people discuss or debate. But in this case, at the e-cigarette summit in Washington, D.C. last May, he presented his findings, and he had an unusual experience. He was booed for the first time in his career.
What happened?
Well, basically, he explained that kids who wouldn't ordinarily smoke cigarettes, meaning that kids who smoke cigarettes tend to have depression, or they might use drugs or alcohol. That's characteristic of young smokers. But he was seeing in his studies that kids who wouldn't ordinarily smoke cigarettes were attracted to these candy-flavored cigarettes. And that's just like they used to be e-cigarettes, just like they used to be attracted to candy-flavored cigarettes, which is actually why the FDA banned candy-flavored cigarettes a while back. So he was telling the audience that, kids who think they might be vaping just flavors could actually be vaping nicotine because the labels aren't always accurate. And he was saying that the evidence was showing that children who were vaping these products, vaping e-cigarettes, actually then were going on to smoke real cigarettes.
It was another way, a new portal.
Yes, people are calling it the gateway hypothesis, meaning that e-cigarettes, you start vaping e-cigarettes, and then you want more nicotine and go on to smoke tobacco cigarettes.
When you talk about candy flavored cigarettes, do you mean candy cigarettes?
Well, they have fruit flavors. They have flavors.
The tobacco is flavored.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Because I'm from the age of when you could actually go to a a candy shop and buy a pack of candy cigarettes. So
yes, I remember those.
those aren't available anymore either, I don't think. But
I'm not sure.
How has the e-cigarette market changed in the last 5 or 10 years? There's every once in a while a vape place pops up and then it shuts down.
Yeah, it seems to be a very fluid market, and it's very difficult to get hard numbers because the industry isn't regulated. But market experts say there are about 8, and the CDC also has quoted this figure, about 8,500 vape shops last year. Mm. So these things are sold in small shops, often run by people who say that they vaped to stop smoking cigarettes, and they want to help other people. Mm-hmm. And you can also get them at convenience stores and places like that.
Is there any evidence that they do help people quit smoking?
Well, yes. So the evidence on this is really mixed. Some studies have found that they are effective as a quit tool, that is the way people in the field call it. And then a recent study, which looked at all sorts of, reviewed a number of different studies, found that they're actually interfere with people quitting. So they were finding that people were actually using them in places where they couldn't smoke cigarettes. Mm-hmm. So they were using an e-cigarette.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about e-cigarettes and how the companies that market them are kind of adapting big tobacco methods. My guest is Liza Gross. She's an independent journalist based in the San Francisco Bay Area. She wrote about this for The Verge. If you have a question or comment, if you use e-cigarettes, if you use vapes, give us a call and tell us what you think about this. Do they help you quit, or do they help you sustain a habit, a pattern, a a lifestyle. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Who owns the e-cigarette industry?
Well, there it's varied. So when it sort of started about a decade ago or so, they were mostly smaller manufacturers, and they were distributors that imported the products from China mostly. And then the way that experts I've spoken to characterize it as the tobacco industry, which is very conservative and risk-averse, as they saw the market take off, they increasingly got involved. And so now R.J. Reynolds, which was just bought by British American Tobacco, its VOOZ e-cigarette product has about a 38% share of the e-cigarette market. And Philip Morris, which is now called rebranded as Altria, has a product that has about... it's called the Mark 10, has about a 13% share. And then there's one more tobacco company that has a similar showing. And so together, the tobacco industry has about 67% of the market.
And how e-cigarette, you're saying that they're not regulated at all by the FDA?
That's not true. So it's just last year, finally, the FDA extended its authority over e-cigarettes. But and they were, there was a deadline of next year, November of 2018, when manufacturers were supposed to disclose what ingredients are in the product, mm-hmm. and also substantiate any health claims. That rule was put in under the Obama administration, and with the new Trump administration, that rule has been delayed. So now that 2018 deadline was pushed to 2022.
So we don't even know really what's in them, or people have studied what's in them, right?
Yeah, we don't. The manufacturers are not required to disclose what's in them, and so that leaves scientists scrambling to try and figure it out.
Mm-hmm. And what have they found?
Well, they found that the idea that is generally is they're supposed to be much safer than cigarettes because they don't contain tar, and tar is a product of combustion that causes lung cancer.
Right.
That's true. However, there are a variety of other chemicals that are associated with the vapor that's produced. Most disturbingly, there are a variety of toxic chemicals and carcinogens that are produced in the vapor. But most disturbingly, for some scientists I spoke to, is that they produce the ultrafine particles that are associated with triggering heart attacks. That concerns them quite a bit.
And is it still pretty much being produced in China?
No, I'm not sure exactly where the full market is on that. I can't quite answer that question, but a lot of products are coming from there.
Let's see. Chris in Columbus, you're on the air with Liza Gross. We're talking about her article that's in The Verge. Hi, Chris.
Hi. First thing I was going to say, those candy cigarettes, they're definitely still around. They're just compressed sugar with a little red coloring on the tip.
Okay.
But I was going to ask about popcorn lung. I've heard a lot of articles about that and going both ways about vapor juice causing popcorn lung.
Well, the concern is that they produce it's the chemical in the flavoring that is associated with this with popcorn lung. They can't say for sure because the products haven't been around long enough to say that this actually produces. If you vape that flavoring, that you will get popcorn lung because it's just the studies haven't been done. But because that chemical is in the vape, produced by the vapor. People are concerned. Scientists are concerned about that.
And popcorn lung, it's some kind of lung disease?
Yeah, it's a terrible respiratory, severe respiratory disease. Yes.
Okay. Chris, thanks a lot for that call. Once again, we'd like to hear from people who use e-cigarettes. What do you think? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Liza Gross, what sort of... you say they're shooting for young people. They're shooting with candy flavored this and that to attract them. Is that what we're talking about when we talk about the methods of big tobacco? How they're adopting the same methods?
Yeah. So the way that that I think about the tobacco playbook is there is marketing to youth, and they deny that they're marketing to youth. The tobacco companies always denied that,
right.
Although you would find their products in magazines that kids by.
Mm-hmm.
But I think some of the bigger issues are that they promote unsupported health claims. So they say these things are really good for you before we have real evidence of that being the case. With the tobacco industry, you might recall the safer cigarettes. There were claims that cigarettes were much safer for you because they had fewer carcinogens, and that turned out not to be true.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is funding science that supports their interests. So what you see when you look at the e-cigarette science is that generally, a lot of the studies that come from industry tend to say that there's not really much to worry about for either the users or the bystanders, but that's actually not what the independent studies are finding. They're finding worrying results. And another thing is that it's very typical to attack scientists who find evidence of harm. So there are a lot of scientists, including, you know, Samir Seneji being booed is sort of a minor event in the scheme of things, but scientists are harassed and bullied on social media and other places.
And it's the businesses, it's the industry that's doing that?
That's a hard thing to tell. I mean, there are a lot of people who really believe that e-cigarettes have saved their lives, and they're very passionate about mm-hmm. this belief, and they are upset when people question that.
Patricia in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Patricia.
Hi. You asked about using vaping for quitting smoking, and
yep.
I know I struggled for a lot of years to quit smoking, and the product that really helped me were nicotine patches. And so I was really struck as you were talking about...
Hey, Patricia, I hate to interrupt you, but could you pull the phone away from your mouth?
Sure.
Okay.
Is that better?
Not much, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, so one of the things that was really helpful about using nicotine patches was that you could know exactly how much nicotine was in each patch.
Right.
And you could step down your dosage. And it sounds like with vaping, if you can't tell how much nicotine you're getting from a product, then I would imagine that would be of much less use than using nicotine patches.
Interesting point. Liza Gross?
Yes, I think that's actually a really good point, because one of the problems why public health officials are reticent to recommend e-cigarettes as a what is called a harm reduction alternative
mm-hmm.
is because the products vary considerably at this point. That's why the FDA wanted to regulate and disclose ingredients, require manufacturers to disclose ingredients. And so the nicotine patch and other sort of nicotine replacement therapies have gone under extensive review through clinical trials to find out safe and effective levels that work for people. And that's why these are actually approved by the FDA to be used by smokers who want to quit. And they also, it seems that the most effective way to quit is using these nicotine patch or lozenge in conjunction with therapy. So basically counseling, not mm-hmm. therapy, but just, you know, to sort of try and change your behaviors, understand when you really want to go for the cigarette, that sort of thing. The therapy in combination with these nicotine replacement therapies shows the best evidence-based, you could say, quit.
But it's also the most expensive route when you get therapy involved.
Well, it's just counseling. There are quit lines that you can call.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily going to a psychotherapist or anything
okay.
like that. Yeah.
Tell us about William Godshall. He's promoted vaping as harm reduction, right?
Yeah. So one of the things that I found was that a lot of the people who are promoting e-cigarettes as harm reduction have long promoted harm reduction for other products as well. And so he's among a group of people who are calling the public health people who are calling for more evidence anti-tobacco extremists, because he believes that they're lying to the public about not telling the public that certain tobacco products have reduced risks. The problem is that these studies have not been done. So scientists I've spoken to say that the way that we would figure out a relative risk, say that, you know, for instance, Godshall has said that smokeless tobacco, which is something that comes in a variety of forms, but you could chew it or just put it in your mouth,
mm-hmm.
Is 98% less hazardous than smoking cigarettes. But there haven't been studies that actually back that up that the public health officials would point to. And so, and then there are other people who have also promoted this Reynolds cigarette called Eclipse as a safer cigarette. And Reynolds promoted that cigarette is having 80% fewer carcinogens and significantly reducing the risk of smoking-related diseases. And so people who are promoting e-cigarettes had also sort of thought that that was going to be a promising way to help smokers reduce the burden of disease. But just a few years ago, Mayo Clinic researchers using state-of-the-art technology evaluated the contents of the smoke produced by that quote, safer cigarettes, mm-hmm. and found that they were every bit as toxic as smoke from other cigarettes.
Just on a side note, starting this past Sunday, big tobacco companies under court order after 11 years in litigation are being forced to advertise about the deadly addictive effects of smoking. What do you think of those ads? Have you checked them out?
I haven't been able to see the ads, and that's actually one of the complaints that tobacco control researchers I've spoken to said. It's basically a result of – so this was this order came after Clinton administration Department of Justice issued a lawsuit, started a lawsuit against tobacco companies for fraud, for deception and consumer fraud in 1999. Mm-hmm. And the decision finally came out in 2006. And that judge ordered them to issue corrective statements about conspiring to mislead consumers about tobacco's harms, smoking's harms. And so it took so long for this is what the tobacco industry does. They issued legal challenges. They sued on every point. Mm-hmm. And finally, the Sunday was the day they were first starting to air. But as one tobacco controller said, by the time this was finally settled, nobody reads newspapers anymore. And who watches network TV?
Right.
And I haven't been able to find them.
I've only heard them on a report on NPR, and it sounds like the lady who does Alexa. So, and I guess they're just black print on white on screens. So
yeah,
it's very boring, but I thought it might look kind of creepy and might grab people's attention. I don't know. We'll have to see if we see them, right?
Yes.
Liza Gross, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Liza Gross, she's an independent journalist based in San Francisco Bay Area and a senior editor at the biomedical journal PLOS Biology. We'll have her story that was published in The Verge, a link to that about Big Tobacco's links with the e-cigarette industry on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I know it feels warm outside, but winter is almost here. December 21st, I think, is the official date. But in the meantime, it's supposed to be colder out there. Be that as it may, maybe there are a few different rules or a few different ideas for how to stay fit in the winter, especially over the holidays. Joining us now to talk about that is Chris Sabo. She's owner and fitness instructor at Sabo Fitness. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
Is it harder for you to work out in the winter?
Not really.
Okay, thanks. Fine.
Oh,
let's put on our empathy cap for just.
I do feel for you and many others. What is hard is actually not just the cold, but because the weather, it gets so dark.
Yeah.
So early. I think that that's one of the big deterrents for people.
Yeah.
And so they have to plan for that.
What about so what do you recommend for staying fit over the winter? How does that change things?
Well, I think you have to take a hard look at who you are as a person. I mean, do you like to be outside? And if that's really important to you, then you have to make sure you plan for that, whether it be what you're wearing, who you're going to be with, because of the weather and because it gets dark so early, you have to make sure you have the appropriate clothing to be outdoors. So I'm a big proponent of being outdoors as much as possible. I would prefer to be out there even if it's really cold, mm-hmm. as long as you have the right gear. And these days, man, we have plenty of those things to get, you know, you can be prepared to run outside, walk outside, do burpees outside.
Oh, burpees, the deadly burpees.
Yeah, so that's what I would recommend. I just think as a culture, you know, we're inside so much. And I think it's just really therapeutic to get outside, particularly for people at a desk job. Mm-hmm. So that would be my first thing. The second thing is, if you're having a hard time motivating to get outside or to get moving, I think it's important to get with a group of people. So whether that be friends or a class or a trainer, you need to get to be accountable, because it's hard to just do it for yourself. So you're coming home from work, it's dark, you don't feel like it, you just want to get in your PJs. It's important to have accountability to somebody else.
The dark poses a couple obstacles. One is just being able to see your way around. It's not safe sometimes to be out in the dark.
That's true. That's true. So it's obvious, but maybe not. To be on well-lit areas, you know, on streets with sidewalks are preferable. Know the rules of the road when you're walking or running. And also, I would say if you're going to go to, you know, a park like High Banks, you just need to make sure that you are with someone. Mm-hmm. I highly recommend you're with someone, because it gets dark. They stay open, I think, till about 8. But it's dark out there. You could have a headlamp. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. I know lots of people that'll run with that, but and a phone.
Mm-hmm. And a phone. We're talking about winter workouts with Chris Szabo. She is owner and fitness instructor at Szabo Fitness. If you have a question or comment or want to share your winter workout strategies, we certainly welcome them. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page and post a question or comment there. We'll have a link to Chris's, you know, Szabo Fitness as well. She's on Facebook on our website at wosu.org/allsides. I always notice the classes I go to in the winter always pick up after the holidays, and then they drop off within 2 or 3 weeks. What do you think people – I get the whole New Year's resolution thing, and I'm a big supporter of it. For some people, that's what gets them going.
Yeah.
What are your recommendations for people to stick with it at that point?
Well, you know, everybody's motivated by different things. So, like, let's take the class, for instance. Some people are motivated by spending the money on a class ahead of time.
If they're going to spend the money, then
they're like, oh, man, I better show up. Now, some people, they don't care about that. So they'll spend the money and then still sleep in or not show up or have an excuse. So money is one. I really think the most motivating factor that I've seen with people I work with and myself is connection with others. So if you can connect with others, you have a sense of belonging and you want to go, because it's not only something you need to do for your body and your mind, but you feel connected to something bigger. So I've worked with groups, like we've done a lot of the Worthington Warrior stuff. We've done a lot of the Spartan training. I would say that the thing people got out of that the most was a sense of connection. And then they were able mm-hmm. to continue working towards a bigger goal.
Sometimes people are shocked by the discomfort they feel the next day after that first big workout, after being sedentary for a long time. How do you work your way through that? How do you recommend people get through that? I call it the toilet test.
The toilet test. What I would recommend is to start out slow. So people love to, you know, I'm not against New Year's resolutions. I think they need to be somewhat realistic. And in order to do that, you don't want to set too many. You don't want to set it way out of the ballpark. You know, if somebody wants to go on a diet, they want to lose, you know, 50 pounds in 3 months. It's probably not the best idea. Mm-hmm. So to start out small. So here's an example. Let's say somebody wants to start working out at the beginning of the year. Like, I teach a boot camp class and I teach a strength class. I would highly recommend they start with a strength class before they jump into a boot camp class.
Okay.
The reason being, you don't want to make someone feel, you know, just discouraged. I mean, you want to be able to have a sense of accomplishment and a sense of soreness, and you want, you know, enough motivation to come back and not get injured.
Because in a strength class, you're not like in a line running with people and comparing yourself that way.
Right. I mean, I think that the not that a strength class isn't intense.
Yes.
But a boot camp class is a pretty high intensity workout where you're doing a lot of cardio, you're doing a lot of like burpees and jumping. And if you've never done that before, it's probably not the best place to start. A lot of people like to start with a trainer and then do a class so they feel a little more comfortable with themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I think getting in a routine is imperative for someone starting out the beginning of the year and having a goal of getting in shape. Or that's always something I recommend, is it's great you want to lose weight or whatever, but it ultimately is about how it makes you feel. That's what's going to keep you going.
Bob in Marysville, you're on the air. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Hey, I bought a light box last winter, tried it. I can't tell if it did good or not, but maybe it helped me from getting worse. What's your opinion about light boxes?
Well, tell us how you used it. What do you do with a light box?
Well, light box is a high lumen bulbs, and you sit in front of it. I sit in front of it in my computer monitor for about a half an hour each morning, and it's supposed to replicate sunlight and eliminate that seasonal adjust disorder stuff.
Hmm. Some people have a hard time getting to it because they just can't face the darkness. It's not a fear factor or anything. It's just feeling awake, feeling.
Bob, did that help you? Are you referring to working out?
You don't know how it.
I don't know. It might have been worse without it. Might have been maybe I was better because of it. It's hard for me to tell. And I just like, you know, according to the manufacturer, this is supposed to be very good and other sources. But
yeah, I've heard
like
about those for depression and stuff like that. But
I have as well. I haven't really heard or read much about them in conjunction with some sort of working out. But it certainly is easier to wake up with light than it is to wake up in the dark.
Sure. So. Thank you, Bob, in Marysville. What would you take on a new client? They're getting started after being sedentary for a long time. What do you talk about? How do you, you know, how does that work?
Well, once again, you know, everybody's different.
Yeah.
So we sit down. First of all, we see if we're a good fit, because I want to make sure that feels
just
good.
Just personality-wise?
Yeah, to both of us, you know, because if they're looking for a certain kind of trainer and I'm not that, it's good to just talk about that right off the bat. I think it's important to find out what motivates them. How are they going to judge accountability? How are they going to judge their results? What are the results they're looking for? And then kind of how are we going to track that? So that's kind of like the first step that we have as we talk about it. And then in terms of actual physical activity, we start out very slow. I mean, it's really mostly about mechanics, doing things correctly, because weight training is a really big part of any program, that whatever anybody wants to do. In my book, I think it's really important. So they need to learn, you know, specific mechanics, because if you don't have those right, you can't build on that. You know, you can't build on that. So,
yeah, it you know, sometimes you're in a weight room, you see people banging around with the weights and they're grunting and groaning and they're slamming them all over the place. And
right.
It's distracting for the rest of us people,
right.
But it's also very unhealthy.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's many ways to weight train. So, you know, that's very true. There's all kinds of ways. But there's a couple of tenets that are really important, like breathing, you know, using your range of motion. And then in terms of reps and weight, you know, that can be played with according to what the goals are of that individual.
The breathing. Big deal.
Do you breathe, Ann?
I try to.
Good.
I laugh my way through a workout and I figure I'm going to breathe and that's somewhere.
It's better
in
than
that.
Crying.
Yeah.
Sometimes better than crying. Yeah. That's one of the things I think we do quite a bit in my classes and with my clients as we talk about breathing. So you're going to, when to exhale, when to inhale, work with your body as opposed to against it.
Oh, shoot. I was going to ask you another question and I forgot what it was. But, oh, warming up in the winter.
Yeah.
Warming up your
yeah.
muscles. Is okay. Anything changed there? People are coming in from, it's you know, 20 degrees outside. They're coming in a lot differently into a workout session than they are when it's 80 degrees.
Yeah, no, that's true. So, I mean, if they're going to be outside, my recommendation is to start out slow. So let's say somebody wants to go out for like a 4 mile run. They're going to probably want to jog pretty easy for the first couple minutes of that. I'm a big fan of dynamic warm up. So that, you know, that is different than stationary stretching. I think there's a place for stationary stretching after you do some dynamic warming up. So if you're coming in from your car and you're going to a class and it's early in the morning and you're stiff, the same thing. You're going to do some dynamic stretching. So it doesn't change as much, but the length of time may be longer with the cold weather.
Mm-hmm. And then going back, I mean, after you've worked out, any cautions about as far as going back out in the cold?
Well, I mean, I would just, if you're in a class again, just, you know, get bundled back up and get back in your car. I mean, it's probably not the best to be in a full out sweat, you know, and then go outside and be in the freezing cold and mm-hmm. and do that, but not really too many dangers in terms of that if you're done with your workout.
Any suggestions for people who do want to do that kind of New Year's resolution and they're starting to think about it now? A lot of people are. They're saying, after the holidays, I'll get to it.
Sure.
Any way to ease it or any ideas for what to look for and what the options are out there?
Yeah, I think a couple things people can think about during the holidays, besides enjoying the holidays, is I think it's important to write down your goals. I think it's important to be specific, and I think they need to be time-bound. And I think people need to really consider what they find enjoyable in terms of exercise because, you know, we can all last a certain amount of time doing something to lose weight or get in shape. But at the end of the day, it's really kind of about enjoying and having a healthy lifestyle. So in order to do that, you have to find something that you think you can last for a while,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And how long should people stick with something to get? I mean, how do you judge when you're getting results and maybe when it's not working and for some reason it's just not getting you where you want to go?
There's a general rule out there of, you know, 3 weeks to make or break a habit. And I think that's a really good general rule. So I think the same goes with exercise. If you want to see something, you need to stick with it for at least 3 weeks and be pretty consistent. And I also would not recommend if you're new to exercise or you want to go gangbusters at the beginning of the year to go every day. You know, I think you need to be like, okay, what's realistic here? You know, maybe 3 times a week. I mean, that's a great goal if you've never been active. Or 2 times a week, that's great. And really anything is better than nothing. And then, you know, just some over time adds onto itself, builds onto itself.
And then mixing things up?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that that's where the connection piece and your folks that you're with are important. And I think then if you can have some, you know, variety in what you're doing, that can keep you present and continuing with it.
How do you get people to exert themselves?
I scream really loudly at them in their ears. No, I'm kidding.
But, you know, how, you know, really push it, push it, push it. How do you get some people don't like to do that?
You know, once again, I mean, this isn't a cop-out answer. I think everybody's motivated by different things.
Yeah.
So there has to be a certain level of internal motivation when they come to a workout, whether it's with a trainer or a class, because you can come to a class and you can duff it all you want, you know. I think that taking it slow over time helps people build confidence in themselves that they can get to a place they never thought they could. And that's what's really exciting as a trainer. And that's what's really exciting, you know, in my classes to see people that are like, oh, my God, I never thought I could do this.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't if you started day one trying to do it. But if you break it down into small bits over time and then you put it together, it's really something.
Chris Sabo, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Have a good one. Thanks.
Chris Sabo, owner and fitness instructor at Sabo Fitness. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shia Lanat, All Sides interns Kyle McKinnon, Courtney Gilbert, Dan Posniak, and Martin Coleman, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Here it is. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.